Well, here we are on the other side of 2020. To add to the chorus, it's been a year. It's been a full year, and in some ways an empty year, a hard year, a bittersweet year, a learning year, a show up year, an anxious and uncertain year. Whew. I'm Melissa Locke, and despite what kind of year this has been, I'm glad to be here. It's an important time to be together. And I am here together with my friend, Greg Meyer, also with Fabric. Welcome, Greg. So what words would you use to describe 2020?
Just one, disaster. Definitely. I mean, 2020 was a train wreck in so many ways, and it's left me reeling. I think probably true for lots of people. But like other disasters in my life, it has also been clarifying. Nobody wants a disaster, but it does clarify what's important and what we want in the future. But yeah, I'll go with disaster. Thanks for asking, Melissa.
Yeah, thanks for sharing, Greg. Mm-hmm. So what now?
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. What now?
What will you do with where 2020 has brought you? What can you do? I want to ask what we will do together. And I have an audacious hope. Are you ready to hear about this? Mm-hmm. I want us to realize and practice. That's right. Love.
That's cute. Okay, seriously. What do you want us to realize and practice?
All we need is love, Greg.
All we need is love. Da, 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 da. Seriously, this is it? Love? Love, like... love lifts you up where you belong, that kind of stuff. It makes the world go round. Okay. Okay. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you again next week. And
no. I know.
It is love, right?
Well, I think we all do have a hunch that this big L love is truly the most underestimated and underrealized force among us. So yeah, we're going to spend 5 weeks practicing and talking about it. Love. Love that changes everything. Revolutionary love. Love that refuses to see anyone or anything as a stranger. So let's land on a few of those words. Strangers. Love. Revolutionary. At first, when I got the book See No Stranger by Valerie Kaur, the book that inspired these conversations, I kind of wondered about the title, to be honest. But as I read it over 3 months with some fabulous new and old friends, shouting out to them, that title, See No Stranger, became more and more compelling to me. I found that No Strangers is not an admonition, but a huge, huge trust statement that says that the deeper reality of existence, the fabric we are all woven into, is love, oneness, connection. That's how I think about God. The Hebrew people wouldn't even say that name, but instead wrote it as an unpronounceable set of four consonants that became Yahweh, translated by many as I am who I am in the story of Moses. This is the flow, the fundamental, the deep bass note that everything else reverberates to. What could happen if we opted in daily to that kind of love? To seeing no stranger as we enter this new year of 2021. Frankly, I don't know. None of us can know. I don't know if this year will be better if I opt into love. I don't imagine we will fix the polarization in our country, stop the violence, solve racism and end poverty, heal the many, many and deep wounds, smooth out all of our relationships, become fully self-actualized. Working for all these things matters. Being excellent and effective at that work is worth striving for, but none of that is guaranteed, ever. And certainly not in our lifetimes, completed at least. But is that really why we choose to love? To fix things? Or people, or ourselves, to arrive somewhere? I don't think so. I think we opt into the labor of love, not to get somewhere in life, but because laboring in love is living. It is what life is about. Love isn't an answer to life's pain. It is a way through it. Glennon Doyle says, pain is mandatory for all of us. It's what teaches us. Suffering is what's optional. That's what happens when we try to skip over the pain. Okay, so I don't think that means all suffering is optional, but there's a lot of suffering that could be avoided if we weren't trying to avoid the pain.
I think that's true, and I think it's a revolutionary perspective. Love is what is able to give pain purpose and what makes it worth enduring. There's far too much emphasis on love as the happy outcome. What happens if nothing ruins an idyllic situation? But that's not how love has played out in my life. Love has been a hard-fought battle, a battle for the other over self, of my true self over my ego, a battle to hold on something precious, to care enough to not give up, a battle that's filled with joy and sadness and sometimes sparking anger and perhaps more than anything else, wonder. All of that, love.
Love is tested in that battle. It's deepened when it has to face the stranger around us or within us. And like you said, Greg, that comes with all those emotions when we make that brave step to opt in. So this year, like every year for the last few, our family read A Christmas Carol out loud together. And hearing my husband Joe read about Ebenezer Scrooge this year, I was struck by how Scrooge starts as the perfect picture of a stranger, this antithesis to love. Here's Joe introducing us to Scrooge.
Nobody ever stopped him in the street to say, with gladsome looks, "My dear Scrooge, how are you? When will you come to see me?" No beggars implored him to bestow a trifle. No children asked him what it was o'clock. No man or woman ever once in all his life inquired the way to such and such a place of Scrooge. Even the blind men's dogs appeared to know him, and when they saw him coming on, would tug their owners into doorways and up courts, and then would wag their tails as though they said, "No eye at all is better than an evil eye, dark master." But what did Scrooge care? It was the very thing he liked. To edge his way along the crowded paths of life, warning all human sympathy to keep its distance.
Scrooge's tragedy was that he had become a stranger among strangers. Everyone was a stranger to Scrooge, and he to them. And that's how he wanted it, thank you very much. Scrooge edged his way along the paths of life, keeping humanity, even his own, at a convenient distance. To Scrooge, people were not valuable as people, just as workers, debtors, lenders, or consumers, tools for the furthering of what he'd made his business. Otherwise, they're a distraction. A distraction to be avoided, ignored, or eliminated. Throw away people. So one reason I believe this story still speaks to so many is because people are still in the business of making strangers of one another and allowing there to be throwaway people who don't belong. People who are outside of our conscious or unconscious concept of normal, and therefore outside my circle of care or concern.
You know what that reminds me of, Melissa? That reminds me of that stage in children. You remember this with your kids and growing up. I sure remember it with mine. When they're old enough to be aware of people and to know them, recognize them, but they're not old enough to understand how the world works. So they lack what psychologists call object permanence.
Oh, yeah.
That means if they can't see you, you're not just out of sight. You don't exist. And that's why your baby cries when you leave the room. They don't just want you to be there with them. They think you're really like gone forever. Now, we as adults should have object permanence down. In fact, I know we do. But yet we do the same sort of thing with people as if they don't exist when we don't see them. I mean, I let people be strangers. And when I do that, I am in essence saying that they don't exist on their own. They only have meaning or value in as much as they register on the Richter scale of my own interests. There's something wrong with that.
Exactly. So if you're a stranger to me, I don't have to know about your struggles, deal with your messiness, or let your needs get in the way of me meeting my needs. I can ignore, dismiss, and simply conveniently just not see you. and therefore not have to change anything. Let's say my partner or parent looks at an emerging or new part of me as strange, dismissing it as a silly phase. They then don't have to open up to the change it could mean for them or for me. And perhaps I respond by dismissing my own potential or my own struggles, and I put up a wall and create distance between me and that potential part of me, or between me and my partner or my parent, this person who loves me and who I care about.
Melissa, what you don't understand is that you are just a prop in the story of my life, okay? And so I'm glad you have all this drama going on, but please, would you please just be Melissa? I've got enough change. I'll be growing and I'll be changing. I'll be doing things and that's fine. But in order for you to play your part in my life, I would rather you just stay who you are. I mean, all this other stuff, that's not my business. All this other stuff that's going on and distracting from my story is not my business. And I would just as well let that all be stranger stuff.
Yeah, that's what we
do. Get out of the picture.
We say, it's not my business. In Christmas Carol, Scrooge says to Marley's tormented ghost, his former business partner, he says, "But you were always a good man of business."
Business? Mankind was my business. The common welfare was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, and benevolence were all my business. The dealings of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business.
Wow, Joe really nailed it there, didn't he? But, okay. Seriously, a world with no strangers means everyone is our business. And we are everyone's business. We are created and called to love everyone, our neighbors as ourselves.
Melissa, that last line you just said is the foundation, the pivoting point of the entire Bible. Loving our neighbors as ourselves. Jesus makes it. Jesus followers say, you know, if you need to know anything to understand what Jesus was all about, what this whole thing about Yahweh, this God, this I am who I am is about, it's loving our neighbors as ourselves. And then, I mean, if you go back to the origins of the Bible, one of the things I love about the Bible so much is it has some important things to tell us and to share with us. And it lets us discover them for ourselves. It doesn't just tell us, it shows it to us and lets us learn the lesson. Like in those very first chapters of the first book of the Bible, talking about creation, you have Adam and Eve, right, living in the Garden of Eden. And Eve is tempted by Satan, the serpent, to eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And she eats, and then she shares with Adam. And then what does it say? It says, their eyes were opened, and they discovered that they were naked, and they were ashamed. I mean, this is the first instance of stranger making, and it is of oneself. They were meant to be just who they were, and they, ironically, it says their eyes were opened, but it wasn't. They were closed to themselves. They now saw themselves as strangers and were ashamed of who they were. And then it goes on, a chapter later, Adam and Eve have children. They have Cain, they have Abel, and there's jealousy between them. Cain kills Abel, and God comes to Cain and says, "Where's your brother?" And Cain says, "Who am I? Am I my brother's keeper?" And the Bible doesn't answer the question. It leaves it open. It's because the answer is obvious. It's a given. Yes, you are your brother's keeper. There is no stranger. There are only brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles. There are neighbors.
Yes, yes. And I think maybe that's why we suffer so much when we live as though we are strangers.
You know, there are quite a few claims that we're going to be making during these weeks of No Stranger. And Melissa, you've hit on a couple of them already, this idea that revolutionary love means no strangers, and that this requires us to opt in. It's a choice. I, frankly, I'm not so sure that these are claims so much as they're speaking aloud things that our hearts have been saying all along in the quietness of inner selves, of our inner selves, and they just need to be spoken out loud. But another one of them is this: separation, separateness is an illusion. We are all, everything is connected. It doesn't matter if you are talking physics, psychology, biology, spirituality, economics, sociology, politics. We are all part of one universe. And in some way or another, what happens to one happens to all. That's a truth we can hide from, but we cannot escape it. It means there are no strangers. There are people we don't know yet, but no strangers. There is only us.
Loving your neighbor is a non-negotiable, but remember, it isn't just love your neighbor, it's love your neighbor as yourself. Loving yourself is also a non-negotiable. So it's important to clarify that choosing to see everyone as connected instead of as a stranger is not asking you to trust everyone or compromise the safety of you or others. Trust is earned and maintained over time, and safety matters. Boundaries and justice are a part of love, not exceptions to it. There are people, for example, who are not safe for you to love right now. It is not your job to trust or love that person up close at that time. That's very, very possible. And that's all the more reason for you, if you are in a position to listen or love someone who might not be safe for someone else, to do it. So Valerie Kaur's book, See No Stranger, offers so much incredibly hard-won wisdom like this about how a public ethic of love can transform us as individuals, our relationships, communities, even cultures and nations. From her own Sikh, S-I-K-H, that is, faith tradition, and significantly from her own experience as a woman, she has articulated this very, very old call to love beyond our own kin. That call to see no stranger. Listen to the opening lines here of her TED Talk entitled Three Lessons in Revolutionary Love in a Time of Rage. Here's Valerie.
There is a moment on the birthing table that feels like dying. The body in labor stretches to form an impossible circle. The contractions are less than a minute apart. Wave after wave, there is barely time to breathe. The medical term, transition. Because feels like dying is not scientific enough. I checked. During my transition, my husband was pressing down on my sacrum to keep my body from breaking. My father was waiting behind the hospital curtain, more like hiding. But my mother was at my side. The midwife said she could see the baby's head, but all I could feel was a ring of fire. I turned to my mother and said, I can't, but she was already pouring my grandfather's prayer in my ear. Dati vanalagi bad brahmsanai. The hot winds cannot touch you. You are brave, she said. You are brave. And suddenly, I saw my grandmother standing behind my mother, and her mother behind her, and her mother behind her, a long line of women who had pushed through the fire before me. I took a breath, I pushed, my son was born. As I held him in my arms, shaking and sobbing from the rush of oxytocin that flooded my body, my mother was already preparing to feed me. Nursing her baby as I nursed mine. My mother had never stopped laboring for me from my birth to my son's birth. She already knew what I was just beginning to name, that love is more than a rush of feeling that happens to us if we're lucky. Love is sweet labor, fierce, bloody, imperfect, life-giving, a choice we make over and over again.
Love is sweet labor, fierce, bloody, imperfect, life-giving, a choice we make over and over again. When you opt in, you are realizing a world with no strangers. In both senses of that word, realize. First, coming to the realization that there are no strangers, that we are all connected, and that there are only others, parts of ourselves, whom we do not know yet. And second, you are helping realize, make real, a world without strangers. You and I are doing the hard work of making our empathy come to be realized. I know I've seen lots of great documentaries and read books, seen movies, and felt like, oh, maybe I can check that box. I had listened, my eyes were opened, but my empathy isn't a destination in itself. It asks something of me. My empathy, allowed to go full circle, calls me to action. This is where we get to hear from Callie Pliego. Callie is part of Fabric. She started experiencing and opting into revolutionary love as a young person, inspired especially by camp and a band she's wild about to this day. As she continues, maybe despite her better judgment, to opt in, here's Callie.
311 song Grassroots has a few lines in the chorus that have been my inspiration for many years to keep opting in to revolutionary love in intentional ways. Here's the line. We waste so many moments standing on convention. The only survey is when our heart pays no attention. For me, being a revolutionary in love is about shaking up conventions. It's about not allowing comfort to distract me from seeing where change, where justice, where connection, where a revolution is needed, and then choosing to labor in love until it's realized. There was a time when a close friend and mentor served me this reminder, along with a proper dose of revolutionary love. I had graduated from Augsburg and was teaching math at South High School, and I was depressed. I didn't have the tools to deal with the compounding pain of losing my college campus community and regretting my career choice, but still also having to show up every day for my students. So I turned to alcohol and partying. I made choices during that period of my life that pushed me into further depression and grief. At the same time, though, a vision was developing in me to push revolutionary love to my own limits by moving to Guatemala to do mission work. I was drawn to the country in ways I can't articulate. I couldn't shake a sense of something urging me or pulling me to start a youth-focused nonprofit there. The big conflict was me telling myself I wasn't worthy of doing that work for the poor choices I had made. This is when my friend served me up some revolutionary love that would change my life. He told me, "Callie, your mistakes do not disqualify you from living out your purpose." That statement and his faith behind it empowered me to go to Guatemala and do what I dreamed about. To this day, Celuz, which means be light, has served hundreds of Guatemalan youth over the 15 years that have passed since I started that organization. For most of these kids, Celuz offered an alternative path to gangs and drugs. And I don't include this information as a pat on my own back, but to demonstrate the power of the non-judgmental encouragement from my friend that day. It's revolutionary love, folks.
That's revolutionary love. It's for others and ourselves. Love is hard enough to exercise towards ourselves and to the people that we see as neighbors. But here's the deal. Love will not be revolutionary for you, me, and our world until we also love our opponents, those who cause harm. The first victim of a hate crime after 9/11 was a man Valerie Kaur called Uncle. His name was Balbir Singh Sodhi. On September 15th, 2001, he was shot while he was planting flowers outside the gas station he owned in Mesa, Arizona. He died. Here's Valerie talking about what happened 15 years later after Balbir had been killed.
So I returned to the gas station where Balbir Singh Sodhi was killed 15 years to the day. I set down a candle in the spot where he bled to death. His brother Rana turned to me and said, "Nothing has changed." And I asked, "Who have we not yet tried to love?" We decided to call the murderer in prison. The phone rings. My heart is beating in my ears.
I hear the voice of Frank Roque, a man who once said, "I'm going to go out and shoot some towheads. We should kill their children too." And every emotional impulse in me says, "I can't." It becomes an act of will to wonder. "Why?" I ask. "Why did you agree to speak with us?" Frank says, "I'm sorry for what happened, but I'm also sorry for all the people killed on 9/11. He fails to take responsibility. I become angry to protect Rana. But Rana is still wondering about Frank, listening, responds, "Frank, this is the first time I'm hearing you say that you feel sorry." And Frank says, "Yes, I am sorry for what I did to your brother. One day when I go to heaven to be judged by God, I will ask to see your brother. And I will hug him. And I will ask him for forgiveness." And Rana says, "We already forgave you." Forgiveness is not forgetting. Forgiveness is freedom from hate. Because when we are free from hate, we see the ones who hurt us not as monsters, but as people who themselves are wounded, who themselves feel threatened, who don't know what else to do with their insecurity but to hurt us, to pull the trigger or cast the vote or pass the policy aimed at us. But if some of us begin to wonder about them, listen even to their stories, we learn that participation in oppression comes at a cost. It cuts them off from their own capacity to love. This was my second lesson in revolutionary love. We love our opponents when we tend the wound in them. Tending to the wound is not healing them. Only they can do that. Just tending to it allows us to see our opponents, the terrorist, the fanatic, the demagogue. They've been radicalized by cultures and policies that we together can change. And so, how do we practice it? In order to love others, see no stranger. We can train our eyes to look upon strangers on the street, on the subway, on the screen, and say in our minds, "Brother, sister, aunt, uncle." And when we say this, what we are saying is, "You are a part of me I do not yet know. I choose to wonder about you. I will listen for your stories and pick up a sword when you are in harm's way."
Thank you, Valerie Kaur. We can teach ourselves to see no stranger. I can choose to wonder about you. This is not only radical for us on the personal level, it's also radical on the societal level. It has political ramifications. Not partisan, but political as in public or civic. It means we need to let this revolutionary love infect and transform our systems, our processes, and our government. What we discover is a cycle, a revolve-olution, so to speak, of love. Realized in ourselves, it increases our capacity to love others. And as we experience our love's impact on others, we're further changed and able to exercise it even more fully in the world around us. And on it goes.
Yes, and growing like this means showing up with your whole self, bringing all the feelings. As much as we get the message that it's best to keep our anger and our grief and even our joy on the down low, Valerie reminds us that to love, all of our emotions are necessary. Wonder is the beginning of love, she says. Grief is the price of love. Anger is the force that protects what you love. And joy is the gift of love. Joy by itself, without the hard stuff, is just not a thing. We know this. So loving like this is hard. It's risky, vulnerable, and so darn inconvenient. But is it really less dangerous, less harmful and deadening as living as a stranger and settling into short-term comfort, but losing our own capacity to love and be loved? I don't think so.
Boy, is that true. It's hard to see everyone, to acknowledge their humanity, to be curious about who they are in such a way as you can actually give thanks for their being, even if you don't like them or you don't like what they do. But that difficulty and inconvenience is nothing compared to the tragedy we live with when we say some people's existence isn't worth noting and that ours isn't worth noting by all others. Remember, we are all connected. When an other loses, so do you, and so do I.
Opting into revolutionary love is a tall order. And yet, we're made for this hard thing. And we do hard things, you do hard things, I do hard things every day. So how can you do this hard thing of realizing this big revolutionary kind of love? Well, first, breathe and push. That is what gets babies born, and it's what gets revolutionary love born too. Valerie Kaur describes what happens when you remember to breathe and to push. We can breathe, she says, to draw energy and power into our bodies and let joy in. We can push through fear and pain to become our best selves, including through healing, forgiveness, and reconciliation. And then we remember, you don't labor alone. So who are you pushing and breathing with? Who are you grieving with? Who offers you safe places to express your loss and your anger? Who is reminding you that you are brave and helping you pause to see and let in joy? So no one person can be all these things all the time. And that is why you have community. That's why you are community for others. And finally, you can do this hard thing because you're going to practice. We're all going to practice. Revolutionary love is not an all or nothing endeavor to master, ever. It will often feel more aspirational than accomplishable, that's for sure. And you will not always be the one to love this particular person at this particular moment, but even wondering about them and aspiring to love opens up space, especially when you just keep practicing over time. As Greg said earlier, it seems impossible to know how to love everyone all the time, and it is. But the practice of seeing no stranger, now that's really quite straightforward. That is an action we can take every day. As Valerie Kaur described it, when you see people, familiar or unknown to you, say to yourself, this is my brother, my sister, my mother, father, child, cousin, neighbor, a part of me I do not yet know. There are a lot of good reasons, big reasons, to opt in to revolutionary love. But I wonder if the biggest one is just because we can. I love it when Joe reads day 5 of A Christmas Carol. It's called The End of It. Listen to him now.
The end of it. Yes, and the bedpost was his own. The bed was his own. The room was his own. Best and happiest of all, the time before him was his own, to make amends in. I will live in the past, the present, and the future, Scrooge repeated as he scrambled out of bed. The spirits of all three shall strive within me. Oh, Jacob Marley, heaven and the Christmas time be praised for this. I say it on my knees, old Jacob, on my knees. He was so fluttered and so glowing with his good intentions that his broken voice would scarcely answer to his call. He had been sobbing violently in his conflict with the spirit, and his face was wet with tears. "They're not torn down," cried Scrooge, folding one of his bed curtains in his arms. "They are not torn down, rings and all. They are here. I am here. The shadows of the things that would have been may be dispelled. They will be. I know they will." His hands were busy with his garments all this time, turning them inside out, putting them on upside down, tearing them, mislaying them, making them parties to every kind of extravagance. "I don't know what to do," cried Scrooge, laughing and crying in the same breath, and making a perfect lacoon of himself with his stockings. "I am as light as a feather. I am as happy as an angel. I am as merry as a schoolboy. I am as giddy as a drunken man. A Merry Christmas to everybody. A Happy New Year to all the world. Hello here. Whoop, hello." He had frisked into the sitting room and was now standing there, perfectly winded. "There's the saucepan that the gruel was in," cried Scrooge, starting off again and frisking round the fireplace. "There's the door by which the ghost of Jacob Marley entered. There's the corner where the ghost of Christmas Present sat. And there's the window where I saw the wandering spirits. It's all right. It's all true. It all happened. Ha ha ha!" Really, for a man who had been out of practice for so many years, it was a splendid laugh, a most illustrious laugh, the father of a long, long line of brilliant laughs.
Scrooge went on even that very day to feel that initial gush of giddiness and unself-conscious joy wear off a bit. As he approached his nephew's front door, he was a little bit wary. Could he really accept that invitation to Christmas dinner that he'd so coldly refused the day before? He had to choose right then to opt in. Regrets, embarrassment, risk, and all. And when he did, he was greeted with warmth and wonder as uncle. I invite you and me to practice this simple and revolutionary choice. This week, make revolutionary love real. Notice when you're feeling judgmental or self-righteous, frustrated, hardened or fearful with anyone. Distant or near, on the news, at home, or even with yourself, and turn to wonder. Say to yourself, "Uncle, sister, neighbor, you are part of me I do not yet know." As we repeat this practice on purpose over time, we open up the possibility of connection, and we begin to realize how revolutionary love really is.
So I think this is absolutely right. This disaster of a year we just had, it has left us broken. It has left us apart and separate. We have turned each other into strangers. I join with you in saying, "Uncle, you are part of me I do not yet know."
Auntie, you are part of me I do not yet know. Say it with us now. Whisper it if you need to. You are part of me I do not yet know.
You are part of me I do not yet know. We invite you to join us in our journey of realizing this revolutionary love of no strangers. We will continue with next week's podcast by exploring the wonder that brings us back to love.
This is a conversation worth sharing. We'd invite you to share the podcast and find discussion resources at fabricmpls.com. And new during No Strangers, connect Sunday mornings on Zoom for music and community-created breakout room experiences. Because Fabric isn't just an interesting podcast, it's a community discovering how to live life woven deeply. Thanks for being part of it.